There were photographs on the walls of Khan's office. I stood up to get a closer look. It is always worth studying a man's shrine to himself. Khan, smiling in a dinner jacket, receiving an award from another man in a dinner jacket. Khan, making a speech at a podium that bore the words Aut vincere, aut mori, the Potter's Field school motto. Conquer or die. The teenage Khan on a cricket field flanked by the King brothers and Piggy Phillips grinning behind them, all of them in immaculate whites, Phillips resting his bat on his shoulder like a caveman with his club. I did not see the photograph of the seven boys in their combined cadet force uniforms. Can I help you? Khan said sharply. Do you get back to your old school much, sir? I said, smiling at him. He was immune to my charms. I speak to the boys. There are various events. I still have friends at the school, among the masters, I mean. There are various military charities the school helps this firm support. Look, what's your point? Best days of your life, eh, sir? Indeed. There was one lone painting on the wall, a hidden corner of the city, a canyon of office blocks glazed with a shining haze, like a city seen in a dream or remembered far from home. There were no people. I already knew what the initials would be in the right-hand corner. J.S. James Sutcliffe, I said. James Sutcliffe painted this picture. James was a genius, Khan said. He could have achieved more than any of us. Why did he kill himself? James was troubled. His parents thought that having those Harley Street doctors stuff him with happy pills would make everything all right, but it pushed him over the edge. You made some close friends at Potter's Field, Mallory said. Khan picked up an unlit cigarette, put it into his mouth, then took it out. He shivered with undisguised contempt. That's what school's for, he said. For a moment, I thought he was going to ask us where we had gone, but he decided against it. He knew we hadn't gone anywhere, and suddenly he was furious. Resentment killed them, he said. Jealousy. This country reeks of it now. He put the unlit cigarette back between his lips. Isn't it bloody obvious? Envy killed them. The officer's mess at RAF Brize Norton overlooks the airfield. From the window I could see a huge fat-bellied aircraft waiting on the runway, its four turboprop engines idle as all around its great bulk men in sleeveless yellow tabards made the last of their checks. A wide ramp was open under the tail of the aircraft, a Lockheed C-130 Hercules. But the troops, in their camouflage fatigues, stood patiently on the tarmac, as though waiting was one of the things they were trained for and good at. The Royal Gurkha Rifles were shipping out tonight. I watched the faces of the men, all those small, golden-faced warriors who somehow looked both gentle and fierce, and far off in the darkness I could see the distant lights of Oxford glinting and glittering in the night. It had only taken us 90 minutes to drive from Savile Row to Brize Norton after the afternoon briefing, but London felt far away. I turned at the sound of a man's harsh laughter. Captain Ned King and DCI Mallory sat facing each other on red leather sofas in the red carpeted room. Mallory was leaning forward, his face impassive, unsmiling, letting the other man fill the silence. Like the men on the runway, Captain King was dressed in camouflage fatigues. "Forgive me," he said, grinning broadly, "but there's no great mystery here. Adam, who I hadn't seen in many years, was a drug addict, and Hugo was a sex addict. These are high-risk hobbies, Detective." "But who would want to kill them?" Mallory said. "Off the top of my head, try Adam's fellow drug addicts, try Hugo's Russian wife, or possibly some of her Russian friends." Mallory nodded, as if giving the matter some thought. "You really think Hugo Buck's wife is capable of killing someone?" I said. King turned his scarred face towards me. He was not smiling now. "I think that anyone in the world is capable of killing someone else," he said. "But your friends died in exactly the same way," I said. "All the evidence suggests the same killer. Do you really think that's just coincidence?" Captain King shrugged. "What I think is that death is random. That's what I think, and that's what I know." From the back of the mess came the sound of snooker balls kissing. Two officers were laughing easily together. Helmand is the only place I've ever seen a man eat his lunch and defecate his breakfast at the same time, one of them was saying. Yes, they're 4 hours and 30 minutes ahead of us, said the other, and 1,000 years behind. Outside on the runway, the engines of the Hercules air transport started up. King suddenly had to raise his voice. I would very much like all those men out there to come back, he said. I don't want them crippled. I don't want them killed. I don't want to see them repatriated in the hideous modern parlance. His broken face twisted with disgust, as if the word physically sickened him. I don't want those good, brave men brought back to face the pity of the Darrens and the Sharons who stand outside Tesco. He smiled without mirth. You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye who cheer when soldier lads march by. Sneak home and pray you'll never know, Mallory said, the hell where youth and laughter go. King chuckled. Very good, detective. Where did you go? Where did I go? Your school. Mallory smiled. I didn't go anywhere. I went to a state school in Banff, in the Highlands. Get to Aberdeen and keep going. But we liked our First World War poets. Siegfried Sassoon, of course, King said, lived to a ripe old age. Died in 1967, but his great friend Wilfred Owen was killed just 1 week before the armistice. The fate of our two greatest war poets perfectly illustrates the random nature of death. I want all those men out there to come home. That will not happen. We arrive in Afghanistan at night, so they can't kill us immediately, but they always get around to it eventually. The really unlucky ones will be wounded and live. Single amputees, double amputees, triple amputees, and full house, both arms and both legs gone, or no balls, no cock, no face. Phallic reconstruction is a growth industry, I'm told. And no cheering crowds for those lads. There will be roadside bombs, there will be friendly fire from our American chums and our Afghan allies. There will be the local policeman who decides that his God wants him to blow up as many of my men as possible. My men will be killed by IEDs. They will step on bombs left behind by the Russians as well as the Taliban. Some of those men out there will come home in wheelchairs, and some will come home in a coffin. Death is the price we pay for life, gentlemen, and sometimes the bill arrives early. And it will not be fair. It will not be rational. You both know that as policemen. Death doesn't play the game, does it? He stood up. Outside, the soldiers were preparing to board the plane. We arrive on Sunday, and Sundays are the most dangerous. They pray on Friday, plan on Saturday, and attack on Sunday. Holy shit Sundays, we call them. But, you know, people are polite there, people are decent. There is no litter at Camp Bastion. Now, if you will excuse me, gentlemen. Thank you for your time, Captain King, Mallory said. We followed him to the door of the mess. As King stepped outside into the chill of the October night, every one of his men turned to look at him. Some of them smiled shyly, and I was struck by their youth, the jumble of equipment they all carried, and their obvious love for their commanding officer. Why did James Sutcliffe kill himself? King winced at Mallory's question. Well, he said, that was all a long time ago. But you must have some thoughts. Why does anyone kill themselves? Because he was weak. I thought he was your friend. James Sutcliffe was more than my friend, far more. And I think about him every day of my life. But James was weak. Mallory nodded thoughtfully. My apologies for detaining you, Captain King. He shook our hands. I wish I could have been more helpful. Just one final thing, Mallory said. King waited. What happened to your face? King laughed out loud. Ben did it, he said, when we were boys. Threw a glass at my head at the breakfast table. Must have said something that annoyed him. Nobody ever asks me that, he added cheerfully, his spirits rising now that he was joining his men. They all assume I copped it in the line of duty. Mallory shook his head. No, those marks are too old. I know what scars look like. Chapter 11. Scout was silent over breakfast. I knew there was a time coming, maybe not that long from now, when she would be able to hide her feelings from me, but at 5 years old, we were not there yet. I sat down opposite her, moved aside a cereal packet with grinning monkeys on the side and looked into her eyes. "Something's wrong, Scout," I said. "What's wrong, Angel?" Scout glanced down at the milky brown gloop in her bowl, then back at me.
"You have to make a costume," she said.
I leaned back in my chair, trying to take it in. "Why do I have to do that?"
"A costume for our play, our Christmas play."
"A nativity play?" She nodded.
"The mummies all have to make the costumes for the children."
A moment of doubt.
"And the daddies. Miss Davies said so."
If Miss Davies said something, then it was burned into tablets of stone and carried down from the mountain in the trembling hands of Moses. "What's the play?"
"The Grumpy Sheep. It's about the sheep that doesn't want to go to see the baby Jesus getting born in the manger. Everybody goes to see the baby Jesus, the wise men and the angels and all the other sheep, but he doesn't want to go, the grumpy sheep. Do you know that story?"
"No."
"He's grumpy, the sheep. Then he's sad. Then he's sorry. He's very, very sorry in the end. He sees the mistake he made."
"A costume," I thought. "How do you make a costume? What stuff do you need?" "What part do you play, Scout?"
"The grumpy sheep."
I was impressed. "You got the lead? The big part?" A flicker of pride.
"Miss Davies chose me for the grumpy sheep," she confirmed.
"That's a good part, Scout. That's the best." She refused to be distracted by flattery.
"I need my costume," she said. "You're going to have to make it."
"I will," I promised, not knowing how to do it, not even knowing where to start. Instead of going to the morning briefing, I drove off the edge of the A to Z, the BMW X5 alone on the road north as massed ranks of commuter traffic crawled into town in the other direction. It felt like nobody in the world was going where I was going. It felt the same way when I sat in the back row of the crematorium waiting for the crowd to come. And they never did. Finally, a handful of lost souls wandered slowly in. Tattooed faces, missing teeth, and the pallid flesh of addiction. So few of them that everybody had their own row. They sat well back, avoiding close proximity to the simple coffin awaiting the flames. When Guy Phillips arrived, ruddy-faced from double games or a hard night on the tiles, he sat across the aisle from me in the other back row. I got up and sat next to him. "Morning, Piggy." He reared back in his seat. "I know you," he said. "You were at Hugo's funeral. The two plods spot you a mile off. Big feet, small dicks." "Have you been drinking, sir?" "Not nearly enough." "And I saw you. You were a bit rough with that girl, Piggy. I think you hurt her." He smirked. "Tasha. She was tired and emotional, that's all. Took her in hand for the best." He took a better look at me. "You were up at Pack's office, weren't you?"
"Pack?"
"Packy Khan." I understood Mr. Khan was Anglo-Indian. "I don't want to split hairs, Constable, but that's a kind of Packy, isn't it? Not that I'm a racist, it's just an old school name, an affectionate nickname. I adore Indians." He surveyed his fellow mourners and sighed. "Christ, this place looks like a convention of big issue sellers." And then to himself, shaking his large red head. "What happened to you, Adam?" "Why aren't the others here, the old gang?" "Well, Ned must be in Helmand by now. Ben's a public figure, of course. Might not look good in the Daily Mail, hanging out at the AGM of Junkies Anonymous. And I believe the Pack's in court, probably defending some gippo's human rights."
"Excuses, excuses."
"I know. It's dreadful, isn't it? But as you can see from his new chums, Adam was always a bit different. Because he was a heroin addict." "Cut him off, did you, Piggy?" Phillips chuckled. "Do you think we care about that? Some of the best families have drug issues, dreadful word. No, Adam was always an outsider. Adam was always different, even more than Packy Khan, who was, lest we forget, a Packy. Think about old Pack, bloody good cricketer, the Pack. Bloody good. Opened the first 11s batting 3 years in a row. Hitting sixes gets you accepted, see, but Adam was a different creature entirely. Not because of the drugs, because he was a scholarship boy. The rest of us
Our parents paid for us to be there. Poor little Adam had to get there on merit, strumming his banjo, blowing his flute. Ooh, I've offended you now. You think I'm a snob. When did you last see him, Piggy? Could you please stop calling me that? It was mildly amusing the first three or four times, but it's what we call unearned intimacy, Constable. Detective. Oh, of course. Sorry, Constable. Piggy is just an old school name, I said, an affectionate nickname.
I don't remember you at school, he said. Were you cleaning the lavatories?
Come on, Piggy. When did you last see Adam Jones?
Not for years. He came to me begging for money. Boo-hoo-hoo, poor little me. Look what a mess I've made of my veins. Don't know where my next fix is coming from, all of that. I gave him what I had and he went away.
It didn't concern you that he would spend the money on heroin?
Not really.
I wasn't expecting him to spend it on low-fat yogurt.
But why would anyone want to kill him? Hugo Buck, I can understand. The woman-beating bastard.
Phillips gave me a sly look.
Not soft on our Natasha, are you?
Bit rich for your blood, I reckon. Out of your pay grade.
I gently touched his arm. I'll ask you again, very politely. Why would anyone want to kill a homeless heroin addict, Piggy?
He shot me a furious look. Look, you've not earned the right to call me that name. It's a stupid name, a childish name. Give me your name. Give me your warrant card number. What exactly are you doing here? I'm trying to understand. You must have some thoughts, and don't give me the line about Hugo Buck banging the help. Don't tell me that Adam Jones had it coming. Your friend Captain King told us that the deaths are unrelated. Mr. Kahn told us the same thing, but I don't think they believe it. And I don't think you do, Piggy.
But he wasn't listening to me. Mrs. Jones had entered the crematorium with Rosalita. They sat down in the front row, directly in front of the coffin. I thought that Phillips was shocked by the sight of Adam's mother. I had seen her far more recently, and she shocked me. Her face was swollen with chemotherapy and twisted with grief. The coffin she stood before could have been her own. But Guy Phillips wasn't looking at Mrs. Jones. He was looking at Rosalita.
Christ, he said. It's the same housekeeper. She's aged a bit.
The minister was talking. Man that is born of woman hath but a short time to live, and it is full of misery. When the coffin had slid into the flames and the curtains had primly swished across the mouth of the furnace, I stood up.
Are you off? Philip said. Very pleasant talking to you, Constable.
We haven't talked yet, Piggy, I said.
As I walked down the aisle to the front, the few mourners coming in the opposite direction eased out of my path with the instinctive cringe of people who are used to getting out of the way. I found Mrs. Jones contemplating the empty spaces.
We should have waited before starting the service, she said. More people might have come.
Mum, Rosalita said, we had our time slot, Mum. 45 minutes, Mum. We had to begin, didn't we?
Mrs. Jones smiled weakly when she saw me.
You came, she said. How thoughtful.
She took my hands.
I enjoyed our talk.
I'd like to talk to you again, I said, about the old days, when Adam was a boy. She was suddenly distressed.
It's all so long ago, she said,
pulling her hands away, turning to the woman by her side.
I don't remember. Rosalita, tell him, will you?
Rosalita put her arm around Mrs. Jones and glared at me.
You upset her now. I just don't remember, Mrs. Jones said.
Of course not, Mum. Why should you? Rosalita said. That's all right.
They disappeared into a side room to collect the sad little pot containing the final remains of Adam Jones. I looked back for Guy Phillips, but he had gone. Everyone had gone. I sat in the front row for a long time, feeling my face burning with the heat of the flames. The crematorium's car park was almost empty by the time I drove away. But at the end of a quiet green lane, I saw Rosalita waiting at a bus stop. I stopped, rolled down my window.
I remember, she said.
I took her to a small cafe in Golders Green and bought her tea. She said she had to send a text message.
My son, she explained, he picked me up.
I sipped a triple espresso as she typed and sent it. Then I watched her staring at her tea. I thought she was already regretting speaking to me.
What do you remember, Rosalita?
She nodded, relieved to begin.
Adam's friends, the brothers, the Indian one. I remember all of them, and the one who died, and the one who was there today. I saw him, a man now. I saw him sitting at the back with you, and I remember.
But what do you remember?
She nodded again.
They would come in the summer. The boys, all the boys would come, when Mr. and Mrs. Jones were away.
When Adam's parents were on holiday, his friends would come. They stayed at the house when his parents were away.
Yes.
What did they do?
Silence.
Then she shook her head.
They were not good boys.
How old was she? Mid-40s?
2 decades ago, she would have been in her 20s. 2 decades ago, she would have been young herself.
Adam was a good boy when he was little, a sweet boy, but he was not good when he was with them.
What happened? Did something happen?
She stared at her tea. She wouldn't look at me.
Did they do something to you?
She looked up as a young man walked into the cafe. Early 20s, the blue overalls of a garage mechanic. He spoke to his mother in Tagalog.
We don't want no trouble, he said, taking his mother's arm, lifting her from her seat.
Wait, I said, where are you going? What's wrong?
We don't want to talk to the police, he said. We don't want any trouble.
What are you worried about? I said to him. You don't have anything to worry about.
But they were not listening to me now. They were arguing in their own language. Rosalita's son still had her by the arm.
Are you worried about your visa status? I tried. You don't have to worry about that. I don't care about that stuff. I can help you with all that.
But they were leaving.
Rosalita, I said. What happened at that school?
She turned at the door of a small cafe.
It all went to hell, she said.
Chapter 12. PC Billy Green lifted the 12-ounce gloves in front of his face and marched slowly across the ring in a total straight line. Fred was waiting for him. My heart sank as I watched from ringside. It was the charge of the Light Brigade in there. Fred stuck out a jab and Green, looking heavier after long days on desk duty, blocked it high on his gloves. There wasn't much force behind the blow, but it was hard enough to slap Green's gloves back against his face. Above the gloves and inside the thick leather headguard, I saw Green's eyes blink with surprise. The bridge of his nose grazed red. Fred danced sideways, light and springy as a dancer on the balls of his feet, arms dangling loosely by his side. Green plodded after him. Fred fired a flurry of jabs. They all detonated harmlessly on Green's tight, high guard. Emboldened, he stuck out a shy jab of his own. Fred's head seemed to whip sideways, as if on a string, and a punch sailed harmlessly over his shoulder. Now Fred was in the corner. He waved Green forward, grinning, the blue mouth guard showing. Flat-footed, Green accepted the invitation. He threw another jab. When he wanted to, Fred had a guard as cozy as a nuclear bunker. Hands held high and close together, elbows tucked into his rib cage, chin down. He bounced against the ropes, inviting Green to hit him, and he did. Jab, hook, jab, all of it unanswered by Fred. Green's confidence visibly rose. He unloaded a right, as slow as a fat man leaving a buffet. Fred slipped the punch and, more from instinct than malice, dug a short left hook into Green's rib cage. The air came out of him with a whoosh, and he sank to one knee, his head hanging down, his elbow tucked into his side, as if trying to understand the source of this sudden and terrible pain. Fred was immediately kneeling by the bigger man's side, a protective arm around his shoulder.
I know I should be able to hit a bit harder, Green said, his face contorted with pain. Sorry.
It's not about how hard you can hit, Fred said. It's about how hard you can get hit and then keep going.
At this hour, the gym was almost empty. They went on the pads, Fred holding up the worn leather mitts for Green to hit, all the while giving him instructions.
Get that jab out faster. Don't let the punch fade away. Harder, faster, sharper. Keep your guard up. You're so lucky to be training.
And behind it all, there was the secret knowledge that boxing gives you. There is good stuff inside you. You are better than you know. Outside Fred's gym, I shuddered in the cold night air and hunched my shoulders inside my leather jacket.
On the far side of Charterhouse Street, the men of Smithfield had begun their night's work, and as they laughed and shouted at each other, their breath came out as steam. Winter was no longer coming. Winter was here. The full yellow moon of October hung low over the dome of St. Paul's. You only see that moon once a year. A hunter's moon, they call it. I turned up my collar and hurried home to take over from Mrs. Murphy. The next day I left Savile Row in plenty of time to make my 2 p.m. appointment with the Right Honourable Ben King MP. The address I had was just the other side of Piccadilly on St. James's Street, and it should not have taken me more than a few minutes to get there. But I walked up and down the street staring at windows and doors, and the address in my hand feeling like a fool, because Ben King's club was behind one of the many unmarked doors on St. James's Street, and if you didn't know it was there, then you were never meant to find it. Through one window, I glimpsed silver heads, all men, dipped behind newspapers. I took a chance, and this was the place. Inside there was a counter where a uniformed porter took my coat. He had hung it up on what looked like a row of old school pegs before he noticed I was still waiting. "Anything else, sir?" he said. "Ticket," I said, already sensing that I had made some stupid mistake. "Sir?" "Don't I need some sort of ticket for my coat?" There was another porter behind the front desk, and I saw him smiling to himself. The porter, who had hung up my coat, grinned with hideous good humour. "Oh, no tickets in here, sir," he said. "Your coat is quite safe with us." I was escorted into the dining area with my face burning. It was more like a room in a private house than a restaurant. Solitary diners muttered to themselves behind broadsheets. An elderly man in a three-piece pinstripe suit sipped a glass of red wine. Another dozed peacefully, a bowl of rhubarb and custard cooling before him. And Ben King, the youngest man in the room, Member of Parliament for Hillingdon North, was rising with a smile to greet me. He was alone at the table, but the waiter was clearing away two places. Because of the timing, I had assumed I was going to be offered lunch. Apparently not. The clean-picked bones of a grilled fish were on one plate, a scrap of bloody steak on the other. "D.C. Wolf," he said, "I'm sorry this was so difficult to schedule. My apologies, please." We ordered coffee, black for both of us. I couldn't risk asking for my favourite, a triple espresso, fearing more blank stares followed by suppressed laughter. And King fixed me with a frank but friendly gaze, leaning forward, giving me his full attention. "My office is here to help your investigation in any way it can," he said, "as, of course, I am." He had a smooth, clean-cut, untouched version of his brother's face. He was a reassuring presence. I could understand why someone would vote for him. "This must be a very traumatic time for you," I said, "losing two close friends in a short space of time." He smiled sadly. "We lost Adam many years ago." There was a pause as the coffee was placed before us. I had been dreading that phone call for years, the one telling me he had gone, but Hugo, that was a blow, yes. "So you were not in contact with Adam Jones? A few years ago he approached me for money, or rather my office. I didn't see him." "And you didn't give him any money?" "I would have given him money for rehabilitation. I would have given him money for treatment. I wasn't giving him money for heroin. I think he approached a number of old friends. Guy saw him." "He told me," I said, and the thought rushed in. "But you knew that already." "It's a tragedy that he couldn't get help. What a waste." Ben King looked at me, and I saw that he had a way of looking at someone as if he was suddenly seeing them clearly for the first time. He cocked his head to one side, as if readjusting his gaze, as if I had just said something unique or momentous or true, as if I was suddenly a man of substance in his eyes, coming out with things that had never been said before. He looked at me as if I were the last man left alive. That was the way he looked at me, but perhaps all politicians do that. "That's three of your old school friends who have died before their time," I pointed out. He thought about it for a moment. "You mean James?" "That was a tragedy. As I get older, I find myself thinking of James constantly." For the first time, he seemed genuinely moved. The 18-year-old suicide, somehow a wound that was more raw than the two recent murders. "Hugo and Adam," he said, "are their deaths connected?" That's our conjecture, I said, echoing Mallory. We're going to be visiting Potter's Field in due course. He sipped his coffee before speaking again. Why would you go to our old school? His voice was calm and quiet. It's just one of the leads we're pursuing. As far as we know, there's only one thing that links Mr. Buck and Mr. Jones, the past. Did anything happen during your school days that might make someone want to kill them? King said. The practiced smile drew some of the sting from his words. He was trying not to laugh at me. You're talking as if their murders were somehow justified, Detective. I didn't mean to give that impression. I'm sure you didn't, he said, forgiving me. He let his eyes drift away as if remembering. We were just ordinary boys, he said, and then back at me. But if anything occurs, then of course I will immediately get in touch. I want what you want. Could I possibly have your card? I gave it to him and realized that I was being very politely dismissed and that there was someone else being brought in to see him, a disheveled, overweight man blinking with awe behind his greasy specs, some kind of journalist, there for an interview, looking like a tourist, all hot and flustered, as if it had not been easy to find the unmarked door of a gentleman's club on St. James's Street. And then I was standing up and shaking Ben King's hand and thanking him for his time and a coffee. I collected my coat from the smirking porters, and I was back on St. James's Street before it sank in that the MP for Hillingdon North had scheduled a meeting for every course of his lunch. I was dessert. That little gang, I said, back at the incident room. It was all about the King brothers, Ben and Ned. They were the alpha males. Ben looks like the pack leader. Why do you think that? Mallory said. The mess he made of his brother's face. Guy Phillips was their pit bull. Salman Khan was their poodle. Hugo Buck was their jock, their star athlete. Adam Jones, I think he just tagged along. Let them run wild at his house when his parents were away. Adam was their mascot, their lapdog. And what about the one who killed himself, James Sutcliffe? They all seemed to love him, I said. Died young, good-looking corpse and all that. I doubt it, if it was so different when he was alive. And he was the one genuine aristocrat among them, the Honourable James Sutcliffe, younger son of the Earl of Broughton. These boys, these men, they all come from money. Even Adam, with his music scholarship, grew up with money. But Sutcliffe was the only true toff, the only one of them that came from a family where the money had been there for generations. He was their hero. We looked up at the photograph of the seven soldiers and at the boy dead centre, dark glasses, unsmiling, hair swept back off that high forehead. I pictured him folding his clothes on the beach at Amalfi and walking into the sea. If they don't hate each other, I said, then who does? Mallory said, oh, everyone hates them, sir. It's that very British hatred with class resentment at its core. We pity the small boys packed off to their boarding schools where they wet the beds and cry for their mothers, but we end up wanting to be them because they have something that the rest of us will never have. Mallory considered the big screen and the grinning boys in their uniforms. It's more than confidence, he continued. It's more than the sense of entitlement. It's the total and unequivocal certainty that tomorrow belongs to them. He smiled at me. Who wouldn't want to feel like that? The next day, I drove us to Potter's Field.
Chapter 13. Now get down on the ground, Guy Phillips said.
50 boys, shivering in their running shorts and vests, stared at their sportsmaster. They grinned foolishly at each other, still hoping that he might be joking. A bitter wind whipped across the school playing fields. 3 in the afternoon, and it already seemed to be getting dark.
Now!
He screamed, and they saw he wasn't joking. Slowly, they got down on all fours. The rugby pitch had been churned to mud by 10,000 stud marks, and their hands and knees made squelching sounds as they tested the ground. Phillips walked between them in his pristine white tracksuit, a grin spreading across his red face.
He was enjoying himself. Not doggy style, toads, on your bellies, on your backs. Roll around in it, that's good. Now on your back, Knowles. Give it a good old wriggle, Jenkins. Come on, Patel, you big girl. Rub it a bit harder than that. Soon, their running gear, white shorts and vests, trimmed with the purple and green of Potter's Field, was rank with mud and damp. But Phillips left them down there as he strode across to where we were watching. A 5 miler through the woods and I'll be with you after a shower, he said to Mallory. Should be an hour plus another 30 minutes or so for the retards. That all right? Mallory nodded, and Phillips jogged back to his boys. The sportsmaster was in a good mood. Get up, he barked, as if it had been their idea to roll around in the mud. Now you don't have to worry about getting your knees dirty, do you?
Sir, no sir,
they chorused. Then let's get cracking. Across the fields, through the woods to the old mill, and back in time for evensong. They took off across the playing fields. Phillips, pristine in his tracksuit among the small, muddy figures. By the time they reached the woods, he was flanked only by the fastest runners, while the bespectacled, the fat, and the surly trailed behind. We started back to the school. Potter's Field was mostly a great jumble of red-brick Victorian buildings, but there were also more modern blocks that were clearly residential, and some more ancient buildings, black and crumbling, that looked like something from the Middle Ages. You blinked your eye, and 100 years went by. Flocks of boys drifted past. They wore straw boaters, the hats on the older boys threadbare and falling to pieces, green blazers trimmed with purple and light grey trousers. All of them lugged books, or sports gear, or both. It hasn't changed since Hugo Buck and Adam Jones were here in the 80s, Mallory said. 1,000 pupils, all boys, all boarding. 3 resident staff in every boarding house, housemaster, house tutor, and matron. We paused to look at the statue of the school's founder in the courtyard of the main building. Not Henry VIII as a fat, bearded king, but as a long-haired scholar and athlete, a lean young man clutching a book, 2 stone spaniels at his feet. The King Henry VIII, who wouldn't hurt a fly. And it probably hasn't changed very much since he founded the place, Mallory added. Did you know he buried his greatest love here in the school grounds? What wife was that, sir? Not a wife. His dogs, Mallory indicated the spaniels. Henry buried his favourite dogs at Potter's Field. We should have a look at their grave. I wouldn't want to miss it. 500 years. I couldn't imagine anything lasting for 500 years. I was always happy to make it to the weekend. There was a small graveyard behind the church chapel. Crumbling tombstones, many of the inscriptions wiped clean by time and weather. But the grave of the dogs was easy to find. It was a large square tomb in the very centre of the graveyard with a short epitaph. Brothers and sisters, I bid you beware of giving your heart to a dog to tear. As we walked back to the main buildings, a coach was unloading visitors from a local state school's rugby team. The state school kids grinned with bewildered amusement at the boys from Potter's Field in their boaters and their green and purple blazers. But the Potter's Field boys gave no indication that they had noticed, which made the smiles on the faces of the state school kids looked like some kind of defensive wound. A towering man in a gown moved among the visitors, nodding and smiling at nobody in particular with his hands behind his back, like royalty inspecting third world troops. I'd seen him before, the impossibly tall man at the funeral of Hugo Buck. That's the headmaster, Mallory said. He's expecting us. Peregrine Waugh, headmaster of Potter's Field College, stood at the window of his study and stared across the playing fields. 3 Prime Ministers, 12 Victoria Crosses, and 4 Nobel Prizes, he said. 2 in physiology, and 2 in physics. 15 Olympic medalists, 44 members of parliament, and 6 BAFTAs. Our drama department has always been very active. The boys were treading the boards, as it were, long before the first old Etonian was admitted to RADA. And 2 murders, I said. He stared at me, over his rimless glasses. What's that? He barked. Hugo Buck and Adam Jones, Mallory said. They were Potter's Field old boys too. Yes, yes. A terrible tragedy, both of them. Did you arrest anyone yet? Not yet, Mallory said. War returned to his desk with a release of breath that might have been a sigh. Although Jones left the school under a cloud, he said, and they are not the first old boys to be murdered, sadly. Persian chap in the 70s, filthy rich, oil money. Mistress clobbered him with an empty bottle of Bollinger on the Bishop's Avenue. He offered us a thin smile. Privilege is no guarantee of a happy life, or even a long one. And we do know we're privileged at Potter's Field, gentlemen. But we give something back, you know. It's part of the Potter's Field tradition, part of our ethos, always has been. Remembrance Day service, a carol concert for the people of the town. We pay for a street cleaner. Potter's Field Lawn Tennis Club uses our courts, and the school's facilities, the playing fields, the swimming pool, are used extensively by local schools and various charities. He rose from his chair and returned to the window. In fact, I think... Oh, yes. He looked at us with a delighted smile. Look. We joined him at the window. The great green playing fields of Potter's Field spread out before us. They were deserted, apart from 3 figures who hovered by the touchline of the nearest rugby field. There was a man in a wheelchair, another with a walking stick, and a third, their physiotherapist, was demonstrating a stretching exercise. They all wore T-shirts. The physio's face looked somehow unnatural, as if he were wearing some kind of mask. The man in the wheelchair had no legs. Where his legs should have been, there was simply nothing. What looked like 2 white bowls were attached just below his waist. One of his arms was a far lighter colour than his black skin, and it was only the weak sun glinting on a curved piece of metal where a hand had once been that made me understand he was wearing a prosthesis. The man with a walking stick had also lost his legs, or most of his legs. 2 thin black poles stuck out of his long baggy blue shorts. What remained of his right leg had some kind of white bandage around the knee area. He appeared to need the stick to stand up, but his upper body was incredibly muscular. And they were all laughing. British Army is still the biggest employer of Potter's Field old boys, War said. Despite what the general public may think, not all the old boys go into investment banking in the city and the RSC in Stratford. We never forget our debt to our country. We watched the 3 men perform a few gentle exercises. The man in the wheelchair and the one with the stick taking their directions from the physio. The man who looked as though he was wearing a mask. Splendid! Splendid! War said, turning away when he decided we had seen enough. You knew them, Mallory said. It wasn't a question. You knew Hugo Buck and Adam Jones. When they were at Potter's Field. You were here too, were you not? 20 years ago. In fact, you were their housemaster. Yes, yes, War said. Did I not mention that? Mallory let him fill the silence. Buck and Jones were both in the Abbey. It's the oldest and smallest house at Potter's Field. Not the most obvious of friendships, the athlete and the musician. But sharing a house throws boys together. Could you explain the role of a housemaster at Potter's Field? I said. War sniffed.
Boarding school is really just a day school with hotels attached, he said. The housemaster is in charge of the hotel where the boys live. He assumes a parental role, encouraging, supporting, and making sure they participate fully in the life of the school. Disciplining when necessary. The thin smile. Although, of course, there's not so much of that these days. Boys don't get flogged, and they don't learn so much. So what they gain at one end, they lose at the other. There were bird-like noises from the far side of the playing fields. Hark, said Mr. Waugh. I believe Mr. Phillips and the boys are coming home. The soldiers saw it first. Mallory and I had left the headmaster's office and were standing on the touchline of the main rugby pitch, watching the state school boys getting thrashed by their hosts, not really noticing the boys as they poured out of the tree line, covered in mud, their thin limbs flying. But the soldiers had stopped their gentle exercise regime and were staring, and then we saw it too. The boys were crying. They ran past us, some of them locked in silence as tears streamed down their faces, some of them making the animal noises of shocked grief. I grabbed one of them by the arm. What's happened? I said.
Please, sir, he sobbed. It's Mr. Phillips, sir. Please, sir, someone's killing him.
Then Guy Phillips came out of the tree line with his hands around his neck and his white tracksuit livid with fresh blood. He stumbled across the playing fields, his legs on the edge of going, his eyes telling us that he was drowning. We ran to meet him, and as he collapsed in Mallory's arms, the blood began pumping out of his wound. Mallory tore off his tie, already covered in blood, and I saw the wound, a far deeper red than the blood that was flowing. Then Mallory was winding the tie around the sportsmaster's ravaged throat, pressing it against the wound, trying to staunch the terrible flood, crouching beside him in the mud. Mallory had his phone in one hand, but it slithered away from him, slick with blood. And I heard him call my name as I began running towards the woods. I was alone in the woods. I kept running until I came to an open field, as barren as the surface of the moon. There I stopped, finding my breath, uncertain if I should turn back to the woods or cross the ploughed field. There was a farm on the far side. I saw the tree I was standing next to had a perfect bloody handprint on its trunk. I looked across at the farm. There was nothing moving. And then something seemed to stir inside. There was a glimpse of a shadow. I didn't know if it was my imagination, or a man, or a trick of the dying light, but I began jogging towards it. There was some kind of square brick pen, crumbling with age, and as I paused by it, I saw that the windows of the farmhouse had all been joyfully smashed. Nobody had lived here for years. I leaned against the low brick wall and jolted when I heard the noise, like a baby's cry. I looked into the pen, and I saw the pig. Its hind legs had been tied with some kind of twine, as if in preparation for slaughter, and fearing for its life, it had crawled on its belly across the dirt of the pen. I stepped over some broken brickwork and crouched down beside the pig. It squealed with terror as I pulled at the twine with my bare hands until I had set it free. It scampered away, wild-eyed with panic. And as I made to stand up, there was a sudden explosion of pain at the back of my skull. And then, following each other so closely that it felt like one blow, the inner edge of a forearm smashed into my throat and a fist hammered into the small of my back. Now strong arms were around me, and he was right behind me, forcing my head back. He was near enough for me to kick him in the shins, but I was suddenly not strong enough to do it. And he was close enough for me to rip his balls off, but suddenly I was too drained by shock and pain to even try. Then he had me. The palm of his left hand pulled hard against my right cheek, his fingertips pressing through the flesh and into my teeth as he twisted my face to one side. I looked down and glimpsed the knife. the Fairburn Sykes commando dagger, the only knife ever designed to sever the carotid arteries of a man's neck. The long, thin blade moved a fraction, and the steel tip pressed into the side of my neck, found a muscle it didn't like, edged forward, prodded the Adam's apple for a moment, and then slipped back to the fleshy, resistant part of my neck and settled there, pressing harder. The knife broke my skin with a sharp prick of pain. I could feel his steady breath on the back of my throbbing head. The wet warmth of fresh blood slid down my neck. I tried to drop my center of gravity. Terrified now, I lashed out with the heels of my shoes. I fought him, and I fought my exhaustion. I bit, and I cursed, refusing to let either overwhelm me. But he held me tighter, and I was weak with pain, and the tip of his knife went in deeper, and the blade was buried in my flesh now. I felt myself sag in his arms. "Please," I said. "I have a daughter." He stopped. A stump of metal at the knife's handle's base banged once against my right temple, and then once against my left temple. It must have put me out for a few seconds, because the next thing I knew I was down on my knees, dizzy and sick. "Please," I said, and when I looked up, I saw the bag. A worn, leather, Gladstone bag. A murder bag. Waiting for him on a dry patch of ground inside the pig pen. A boot steel toe cap slammed with full force into the base of my spine. The pain was blinding. I saw yellow light and exploding stars. I felt my back go into spasms of agony. I realized I was screaming. There were noises and lights, but they were all inside my head. I dragged myself away on my hands and knees. I could not stand. I kept crawling. My muscles were paralyzed slabs of pain, and only my fear kept me moving. Time meant nothing, but I knew it was passing because the ground changed beneath me, from the hard, churned mud of the plowed field to the carpet of dead leaves that covered the woods. And finally, I was on grass. Now I heard voices that were not inside my head. Then there was hot breath on the side of my face, and I reared away in mortal panic. "Please," I said, and I stared into the terrified face of the pig. November. Dreams of the Dead. Chapter 14. I lay on my bed in the darkness, and the sound of my daughter playing with the dog in the main room edged me closer to sleep. It was a soothing sound, their play. Scout's laughter like temple bells, and the soft padding of the dog as he chased after whatever chewed-up old toy she was trailing. But then another spasm of pain would grip my back, and I would jolt awake. When they found me at the edge of the playing fields, they had taken me to the nearest A&E to Potter's Field. The doctor wanted to keep me in overnight, but that was impossible. I had to go home to Scout. So, after the usual routine, lights in the eyes, questions about being sick, checking for broken bones, the doctor reluctantly let a uniformed officer drive me home, where Mrs. Murphy took one look at me and packed me off to bed, saying she would call her family, take care of Scout, and sleep on our sofa. For a night and a day, I stayed in my bed. True rest, always just out of reach. The pain never far away. The tremors began at the bottom of my spine and rolled all the way to the base of my skull, and it was like every muscle in my back, shoulders and neck was clenching at once. At first, the pain had an exact center, the spot in my back where he had kicked me. But as the hours dragged by in that exhausting place between sleeping and waking, that center point seemed to migrate up to a shoulder, across to my ribs, to my neck, to the very middle of my back, as if it was seeking a happier home. I never knew where it would be next. But the muscle spasms were the worst. They made me arch my back whenever another wave of blinding pain rolled through me. I almost cried out loud with the latest one.
"Daddy."
Scout was in the doorway. I thought I had frightened her, but she was holding the phone.
"It's some lady,"
she said. I waited until she was in the other room, and I could hear Mrs. Murphy quietly talking to her, telling her they needed to fix her hair. Wolf, I said.
Scarlet Bush.
I could hear the excitement in the reporter's voice. You met him. You met Bob the Butcher. I don't know who I met. It has to be Bob. How did you get this number?
We want to help you find him, she said.
My editor has spoken to our proprietor. We have his full backing to help you bring Bob the Butcher to justice. You stitched me up. Your bloody story put words in my mouth that I never said. She remained completely calm. E.L. Doctorow said, I am led to the proposition that there is no fiction or non-fiction. As we commonly understand the distinction, there is only narrative.
You mean you make stuff up?
Not quite. I mean there are facts, and then there's the truth. She paused. Was that your little girl who answered the phone? Was that Scout? I struggled to contain my anger.
Never call my home again.
Did you see his face?
Never speak to my daughter.
Did he talk to you?
Stay right away from her.
Did you say something to him? A spasm of pain clenched my back. I bit down against it, my mouth tight shut, and ragged breath came from my nose. It made the reporter feel like she was onto something.
You did, didn't you?
Please, I have a daughter. Begging him. Begging a murderer for my life. Sick with the fear. Unmanned by the terror. Please.
What did you say to him, detective? Did you reason with him? Did you threaten him? How did you feel?
We are hearing reports about the murder weapon, some kind of special forces knife. Old school. I could hear her tapping a keyboard.
A Fairburn Sykes commando dagger. Is that what you saw?
I cursed under my breath. Where did they get this from?
One final question, she said. Technical point. A third murder is the game changer, isn't it?
Her tone was lighter now. She was happy.
Because when we have three murders, it's official. We have a serial killer. That's true, isn't it?
I hung up. Stan padded into the room and watched with interest as I tried to get dressed. He cocked his head to one side as I struggled to get my socks on. There was no longer enough give in my back for me to bend forward.
You're not allowed in this room, I said. Go on, Stan, get out.
He lay down, still watching me, sitting on the bed. I pulled my shirt on. Stan rested his chin on his front paws. I buttoned up the shirt and had another go at my socks, but it was no good. The muscles in my back were petrified. Apparently bored with my pathetic efforts, the dog got up and yawned. Then he stretched, first lifting his tailbone in the air, his chest almost touching the ground, and then rocking forward onto his front legs, his hind legs and back almost a straight line. Then he looked at me. You try it. But I knew if I got down on the floor, I would need the fire brigade to get me up. So I stood with my forearms resting on the bed and pushed back with my tailbone, feeling the stretch in my lower back. Then I rocked forward, and there it was in my hamstrings, the sweet feeling of muscles that had been sleeping suddenly waking up. I kept doing it, rocking back, rocking forward, a modest approximation of my dog's stretches, until I was sweating and breathless, but finally loose enough to sit on the bed and pull on my socks. Stan watched me. Yeah, he seemed to be saying, you got it. Scarlet Bush was right. Three deaths, and we were no longer hunting a murderer. We were hunting a serial killer. But we were not there yet. Piggy Phillips was lying in a hospital bed, breathing through a ventilator because of the puncture wound in his windpipe. Uniformed officers outside his door 24 hours a day as he stubbornly clung to life. Chapter 15. There is a canteen in 27 Savile Row, but just the other side of Regent Street, all of Soho is waiting for you with every kind of food in the world. So if you work out of West End Central, the back streets of Soho are your real canteen. I found Elsa Olsen in a Korean restaurant at the top of Glasshouse Street. The forensic pathologist was just polishing off a bowl of dak bulgogi and steamed rice. You look like death warmed up, Max. I eased myself into the chair opposite her. Coming from someone in your job, Elsa, I'm going to consider that a compliment. She waved her chopsticks. You want something to eat? I shook my head. If you don't want lunch, then you're here to ask me about a man with a knife wound in his windpipe, she said. I smiled at her. You know me so well. You want to know if he's going to live. It had crossed my mind. That depends entirely on the severity of the penetrating trauma. It's a puncture wound, Elsa. A knife was stuck in Guy Phillips's throat, but his throat was not cut open. I'm giving you the edited highlights, you understand? I understand. But you have to understand that there are puncture wounds and there are puncture wounds, Max. Tracheal perforation ranges from a small wound to complete avulsion. He survived for, what, 48 hours? Yes. Then I would think he has every chance. But not even his doctors will know for certain. If you don't like Dak Bulgogi, you'd be far better off talking to them. There's something more, Elsa. She placed her chopsticks across her rice bowl and waited. I leaned forward. My back throbbed in protest. Would he have lost consciousness? I said. He had a knife stuck in his throat. The assailant was disturbed, we don't know why, and the victim somehow stemmed the blood for long enough to save his life, long enough to get up and get away. Was he awake through all of that? Now, I got a couple of taps on the head, and there were whole seconds when I was out for the count. This man had his throat cut. Would he have blacked out? She thought about it. I don't know. Please, Elsa, have a guess. I doubt it, because if he had blacked out, then he would have bled to death. But like you, there may have been moments when he was not fully conscious. What's the timetable? There is no timetable. There are only a series of approximations. But we know that Hugo Buck and Adam Jones died almost instantly. Yes, because if you cut the carotid artery, then loss of consciousness is within 5 seconds. But even that's an approximation. And the killer didn't get the chance to cut the carotid artery this time, did he? Because he was disturbed, or he panicked. There were 50 kids in those woods. Or maybe he was spooked by a bird. Whatever happened, he didn't finish the job. So did Guy Phillips lose consciousness? What I'm telling you is that severing any artery will eventually result in loss of consciousness. Eventually. Suicides who cut their radial arteries, slash their wrists in plain English, have approximately 30 seconds to regret it before they black out, and then another 2 minutes before they die. But it is entirely dependent on the severity of the trauma, or more specifically, the loss of blood plasma. So how about a punctured windpipe, Elsa? My guess is that the victim was awake all the time. Even with an open wound in his windpipe, he was always awake. That's what I think. What do you think, Elsa? I know exactly what you're asking, Max, and I'm not going to give you an answer, because I just don't know, and there's no way I could possibly know for certain. A waiter brought a bowl of kimchi and placed it in front of Elsa. She did not look at the waiter, the kimchi, or me. She stared out at Glasshouse Street, which is really little more than a glorified alley that runs parallel to Regent Street, and she sighed, shaking her head. I did what I had seen Mallory do. I let the silence between us grow and wait for her to fill it, and eventually she did. A body only has to lose approximately a fifth of its normal blood volume to produce hypovolemic shock. Lose that amount of blood and the heart stops pumping. Veins dilate, blood pressure drops, and eventually you flake out. Yes, if we're going to use the medical term, you flake out. But that didn't happen to Piggy, because he didn't lose enough blood. He lost a lot of blood, a hell of a lot of blood, but not enough to put him out. That's a reasonable supposition. So the killer sticks the blade in his neck, cuts through the windpipe, but doesn't finish the job. Something spooks him, and he lets the man slide from his arms. But Phillips doesn't black out. Just so we're clear, he doesn't black out, right? Elsa reluctantly nodded. And then finally she gave me what I'd come to Soho to find. I know what you are asking, and the answer is yes, she said. She picked up her chopsticks and selected a slice of kimchi. The chili soaking the Napa cabbage was as bright as fresh blood. There's a good chance Guy Phillips saw his assailant's face. A uniformed sergeant was outside the main entrance to the hospital, red-faced and stamping his boots. He's still alive? I said. It wasn't a question. The PS gave me a grin, indicating the deserted street outside the private hospital. You'll know soon enough when he snaffed it, he said. They'll all come running. I nodded. The death of Guy Phillips would swamp the street with cameras and microphones, because then we would have a serial killer. There was another uniformed officer outside the lifts. I didn't recognise him, and I had my warrant card in my hand before I reached him. All quiet, I said. These nurses keep bothering me, sir, he said. They love a man in uniform. I stepped into the lift. You'll just have to try to be strong, I said, thinking that they should teach mindless banter at Hendon, the training school of the Metropolitan Police. The gangly figure of PC Billy Green was waiting outside the intensive care unit. He looked half asleep but snapped to attention when he saw me coming. Back on the beat, I said. He grinned. Yes, DC Wolf. Visitors? The same gentleman, Green said. His friend, the politician, Mr. King? It still restricted visitors, but Mr. King must have had a word. The door to the ICU opened and a doctor emerged. Doctor, I said, DC Wolf, when can I talk to your patient? Detective, he said, Mr. Phillips has a severe tracheal rupture. Someone, as you know, stuck a knife through his windpipe. 30% of patients with tracheal tears die, most of them within 1 hour. I get it, I said. I understand the severity of the injury. I'm not convinced you do. Mr. Phillips is currently sedated and breathing through a ventilator. If he survives, he will need extensive surgery to repair the severed windpipe. If he has surgery, even surgery that is successful, he will have breathing difficulties for the rest of his life, due to a narrowing of the airways in his throat. He looked up from his notes. And you're seriously asking me when you can talk to him? Because we believe he may have seen his assailant's face, I said. He wouldn't have to speak, he could write something down. The doctor looked at me with open hostility. He's not well enough for visitors, he said, and I'll let you know when you can talk to him. He walked off. I gave Green my card. If he wakes, you call me. If his condition changes, you call me. And if there are any problems, what do you do? I call you. Good. Then I entered the intensive care unit. PC Green followed me inside, concern flitting across his face as he watched me scrub my hands in one of those big, deep sinks you only find in ICUs. Don't worry, I said. I'm not going to operate on him, and I'll be quick. I went inside Phillips's room. In the gloom, I could see a figure propped up in bed. I could not recognize him as the man I had last seen emerging from the woods at Potter's Field, with blood pouring through hands around his neck. Guy Phillips looked like the sole survivor of some catastrophic disaster. He looked like someone I had never met. Three tubes, two fat and corrugated, and one thin and smooth, snaked over the side of the bed like tentacles, and were connected to another tube, which in turn was connected to his nose and throat. The doctor had told me that the puncture in his trachea meant that he could only breathe through a ventilator, and the doctor was right. I didn't really understand what that meant until I saw him and heard him. The ventilator made every single breath Piggy took sound like a small war. His neck was swathed in bandages, which made him look like a relic from an Egyptian tomb, or as if someone had tried to decapitate him. There was no blood. Detective Wolf, a voice said. And only now did I see Ben King sitting on the far side of the room, hunched up in the solitary chair. I want to thank you for saving Guy's life. His voice was very soft, and although there was no chance of us waking the man in the bed, I responded in the same hushed tones. I don't deserve any credit for that, I said. Thank DCI Mallory. He stopped him bleeding to death. Of course, and I will thank him personally. Have you any leads? No. I hesitated for a moment. But we think he saw a face. We think he can identify whoever attacked him. And we believe he will when he wakes. When he wakes, Ben King said, then let's hope he wakes soon. He stood up in the darkness, and I thought he was leaving, but he just wanted to shake my hand. There were tears in his eyes as he held my gaze. This has to end, he said. These senseless murders, this unspeakable violence. I want to end it, I said. His eyes blazed at me in the twilight of the hospital room. And that was when I felt the full force of his personality, and I understood exactly why he had climbed so far, so fast. And I want what you want, he told me. Chapter 16. I recognized her as soon as I walked into MIR1 the next morning. She was alone in the room, having arrived even before Mallory, sitting on a desk looking at a laptop that was open on a PDF of the murder investigation manual. She turned to look at me with a cool, steady gaze that I remembered from my first day in homicide, up at the bank, Hugo Buck on the shag carpet with his throat opened up. It was the rebellious red hair that really gave her away. Everything else seemed different, because this time she was not in uniform. DC Wolf, she said, I don't know if you remember me. From the 101 at China Corps, TDC Edie Wren. I remember. You're a trainee detective constable now. How did that happen? The usual way. I passed my national investigations exam. I'm working towards my PIP Level 2 portfolio, you know, demonstrating competence, all of that. What are you doing here? I'm the bagman on the double homicide. Our bagman? The bagman's usually a detective sergeant or detective constable. Cuts, she said. The bagman was the lowest rank of the investigation, answering directly to the senior investigating officer, DCI Mallory, and giving assistance wherever it was needed. I remembered how calm Wren had been on the day she and Green found Buck's body, and I had no doubt she could do the job. So this is where it all happens, she said. This is where some of it happens, I said. There's plenty of legwork outside. I've learned that murder is labour-intensive. In the Yorkshire Ripper case, the law checked over 5 million car registration numbers. Yes, and they still cocked it up, she said. Did you see the new Bob the Butcher post? She stabbed a few buttons on her laptop. A social network site came up. It was nothing I hadn't seen before. The later photograph of Robert Oppenheimer, the same apocalyptic boasting, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds, kill the protectors of the rich, kill all pigs. Seen it, I said. But did you see the link? Wren said. That's new, and you're in it. She clicked on the link, and there I was, on my hands and knees, a thin trickle of blood running down the side of my face from a wound in my temple, another sliding down the side of my neck. My mouth was open, and my eyes were fixed on nothing. And I was crawling. It was only a few seconds of footage, but it kept repeating and looping back on itself, so it looked like I was crawling forward and then reversing, as if doing some comic jig. In one corner of the screen, the pig edged towards me, its eyes bulging with terror. Our faces would almost touch, and then we would back away from each other, and then the mad dance would begin again. There was music, I realised. Not really music at all, just mad laughter, on and on, hysterical screams of laughter, over an oompa-oompa beat, as the pig and I crawled towards each other and then backed away, and did it again. Laughter in the dark, laughter from the grave.